Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, the work of diplomacy is subtle, but the actions of world leaders are sometimes the opposite. Famed American diplomat Madeleine Albright confronts the dangers of undiplomatic and undemocratic political trends in her new book, Fascism, A Warning. The book explores the history of fascism and the current state of the public's faith in politics, the media, and even science. While making clear she is not calling him a fascist, she calls out President Trump as one of the leaders who undermines public confidence in democracy. Albright and her co-author Bill Woodward write about how fascism begins with, quote, a seemingly minor character, unquote, someone who claims to be the only person who can fix a country's problems. In this conversation, Albright touches on, among other things, her origins as a refugee, how she became a diplomat, Vladimir Putin, the North Korea situation, and of course, the pins, one of her signature diplomatic tools. Madeleine Albright was the first woman to serve as U.S. Secretary of State. In this Seattle Arts and Lectures sponsored event, she spoke with Mark Sussman of the Gates Foundation on Tuesday, April 24th at the Paramount Theater. KUOW's Jenny Cecil Moore recorded the conversation. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
My name is Ruth Dickey, and I have the tremendous pleasure of serving as the Executive Director of Seattle Arts and Lectures, and I'm thrilled to welcome you to an evening with Madeleine Albright. To officially open each of our events, we feature a student from our Writers in the Schools program. This year, Writers in the Schools is working at 27 area public schools and at Seattle Children's Hospital to match them with local, professional, creative writers for year-long residencies to inspire more than 6,000 young people to write their own poems, stories, and memoirs. Tonight's reader, Siri Ganholm, is a member of our Youth Poet Laureate cohort and will be sharing her poem, If You Had a Mask. Siri is a student at Garfield High School and also an intern with our WITS program. Please join me in welcoming Siri.
If you had a mask, it would be woven out of feathers and would obscure all of you as if you had been swallowed whole by your own mouth and shame. Broken glass would be your crown, the remnants of your days in cages, and your hair would be dyed a natural color to match your eyes. Through the eye holes, you would see a world largely unchanged, but for its newfound clarity, unobstructed by mineral rain. Reaching into your lungs, you would decipher mountains and cities populated by the cavity left behind by an earthquake. Your feet would make the ground invisible and would be covered in plaster to hide those scars you received from running through the rocks. Your ears, fox-like and big enough to scare away your predators. You see, you are like an animal, perhaps bent and broken, but unable to rebuild anything but walls. Thank you.
Early in her important new book, Fascism, A Warning, Madeleine Albright points to the rise of Mussolini and Hitler and Franco and writes, quote, fascism caught on because many people in Europe and elsewhere saw it as a mighty wave that was transforming history, that was owned by them alone, and that couldn't be stopped. Fascism, A Warning is a powerful book about this mighty and menacing wave. Its history, its present, and cresting future. Albright taps her personal history as an immigrant, a professor, a historian, a diplomat, to bring perspective to both the rise, the history of fascism and the rise of fascist leaders, and to analyze and situate the rise of extremism and hate sweeping the globe today. Dr. Albright was the 64th Secretary of State of the United States and the first woman to serve in that role. From 1993 to 1997, Dr. Albright served as the U.S. permanent representative to the United Nations and was a member of the President's cabinet. She is a professor in the practice of diplomacy at my alma mater, the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. And in 2012, she was chosen by President Obama to receive the nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, in recognition. In recognition of her contributions to international peace and democracy. She's the author of 5 New York Times best-selling books and the proud owner of the most politically significant and stunningly beautiful pin collection in the world. We are proud to have her here with us tonight and proud to be celebrating the publication of this important book to help us all understand the past and ask important questions about how to safeguard democracy and freedom in the present. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Madeleine Albright.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Secretary Albright, welcome to Seattle. As you can tell, people are very pleased to see you here and to hear from you this evening, and thank you so much for taking the time.
I want to thank Ruth for the introduction and telling everybody who I am, because not everybody always knows. Not long ago, I was coming back from China, and Chicago was the first port of entry, and I was there getting undressed for the security people, and I put my stuff down on the conveyor belt, and the lady behind me said, "So where'd you get all those screw top bottles?" I said, "At the container store." Then I was going through the magnetometer, all of a sudden the TSA guard says, "Oh my God, it's you." He said, "I'm from Bosnia, and we all love you in Bosnia, and if it weren't for you, there wouldn't be a Bosnia, and you're always welcome in Bosnia." He said, "Can I have my picture taken with you?" And I said, "Sure." And the whole line gets screwed up, and I go back to get my stuff, and the lady of the screw top bottle says, "So what exactly happened here?" And I said, "Well, I used to be Secretary of State," and she said, "Of Bosnia?" So, so Ruth, thank you.
Well, I think Bosnia would happily have you as Secretary of State, as would many other countries in the world.
Yeah.
But maybe if we start actually where sort of Ruth did with the framing and the quote from your book, fascism is just not a term that's been used in public discourse for a very long time, for good reason. But it's now staring, and everyone's in the book, from the cover of your book, and it's attached to a second phrase, a warning. What is the warning, and what really motivated you to write this book?
Well, first of all, Ruth also mentioned about my background, and I really, with my family, were victims of fascism. I was born in Czechoslovakia in 1937, and 2 years before the war, and a watershed event for Czechoslovakia was the Munich Agreement, in which the British and French made an agreement with the Germans and Italians over the head of the Czechoslovaks in order to accommodate a German minority that had been propagandized by a disciple of Hitler's, Konrad Henlein. And they made this agreement, and the country I was born in was sold down the river. Then in March 1939, the Nazis marched into Prague, and we left because my father was a Czechoslovak diplomat and the government in exile was in London. We came back after the war, and then my father was made ambassador to Yugoslavia, and then we had to leave again because of communism. And so I did not know until much later, until actually I became secretary, that my family, 26 members of my family, had been murdered in the Holocaust. And so understanding more about fascism generally has been a very important and personal history for me. But the warning is that there are certain steps that were kind of, the book is really quite historical in terms of looking at how Mussolini came to power and then Hitler, and looking at some of the things that are going on in Europe now and in the Philippines and in Venezuela, that there really are certain steps that one can see. And Mussolini, there was I think one of the most interesting quotes in my book is what Mussolini said, that if you pluck a chicken one feather at a time, it won't be noticed. And so I see feathers being plucked, and that's the warning. And I think that we have to understand better what fascism means and how it comes into place.
Well, another quote you have from Mussolini, talking about the origins of fascism, is you talk about how he had very little tolerance for dissenting opinions in his cabinet. And I think you have a quote from him that he said, "Often I would like to be proven wrong, but it's never happened yet."
Yeah.
Do you see any other parallels or warnings?
Well, he also actually did say he wanted to drain the swamp in Italian. And I think that one of the things, by the way, I want to make something perfectly clear that I am not calling Trump a fascist. I do think, however, that there are certain signs that make me very nervous in terms of somebody who does think that he's always right and that he can solve every problem and doesn't like a lot of dissent. But one of the things that really does bother me is that it is clear that there really are certain things that are going on in terms of declaring the press an enemy of the people. And just to go back on something, I have taken a look at Mussolini and Hitler, but also have taken a look at what's going on in Hungary and in Poland and Turkey, Russia, then Venezuela and the Philippines, a number of other places. And there's a common theme, which is accusing the press of being fake, of making up facts, of those that have no regard for democratic institutions, that really exacerbate the differences that already exist in every society for a variety of reasons, and and identify with a group at the expense of the other group. So it's a kind of us versus them activity. And those are the kinds of things that some of which I can see happening in the United States and some among our allies that are in this same position of exacerbating the divisions, having no respect for democratic institutions, thinking they're above the law, and generally propagandizing our societies by using the media against us.
So I want to come back to the United States in due course, and I'm sure there'll be lots of questions from the audience, but just even on that answer, you stretch from Venezuela to the Philippines to Hungary. This is something happening all over the world right now. Why do you think it's such a global phenomenon?
Well, I think that I have kind of been talking about the fact that we're in a third era after the end of World War II. So what happened after World War II, we had the Cold War, and the world was divided into red, white, and blue, and there were a lot of policies determined by how we dealt in the Cold War. The second era was after the end of the Cold War, when the Berlin Wall came down, and there really was a sense of great hope, frankly euphoria, in terms of the possibilities of a lot of country becoming democratic and the multilateral system working and a lot of cooperation. And then 9/11 happened, and I do think that we then entered a third era, which then was also accompanied by major changes in technology and a disappointment with the kinds of things that we thought were happening in the second era. And so I think we are in a time when things are genuinely in disarray, but the reason that I see this happening in various places is there has been, and whether it's a result of the financial crisis or of technology that has left people without jobs, or the training to take the new jobs and has disaggregated voices, that people don't quite know where we are at this point. So there are these divisions in society, whether it's here or in Hungary or in all those places. And then there is a leader that shows up that says, "I've got the answer to this." And so the thing that I think distinguishes fascism as a concept in difference to just plain old dictatorship, is that there's a movement from the bottom of people that are dissatisfied, and then the leader from the top who takes advantage of that dissatisfaction, makes it even worse, and comes up with simplistic answers. And then the other thing that is a category or a symptom is you have to blame somebody. And what we have seen is there's always a scapegoat because it's somebody else's fault. And it comes as a result of hyper-nationalism, and you think the foreigners are the ones that have created the problems. And what has happened in all the countries that I've been talking about, there is a lot of refugees and migration going on. So the Hungarians, for instance, have blamed the migration policy for closing their borders. And you see that in a lot of places. So this blaming the other for this, and usually some kind of a foreign group, whether religious or linguistic or something, which you blame everything on them, that scapegoat concept.
So you mentioned just your own family history and finding relatives who died in the Holocaust. And just sticking with the Hungary example, just even since you wrote the book, there's been another election in Hungary, and the incumbent president won with a larger majority. And part of his campaign was very much singling out George Soros as an enemy. And there's a lot of discussion about whether that is in itself a kind of form of anti-Semitism or resurgence of anti-Semitism in Europe, using that kind of other and outsider. Just both with the specific Hungary example, but more broadly in Europe at the moment, and sticking in Europe, are you concerned about a resurgence and that wider anti-Semitism itself with other trends? You talk a lot about the growth of the Muslim community in Europe in your book too, and how that is playing into the whole conflict.
Well, let me just say a little bit of background on Viktor Orban. I first met him in the 80s when he was everybody's favorite dissident. And he was a young guy who was fighting against communism, and he was funded by George Soros to go and study at Oxford. And he came to the United States, and people thought he kind of was this part of this euphoric view of what really could happen. And what is the issue, I think, one of the other things that happens is kind of working to change the constitution of any country and say they can have lifetime or changing the rules of elections. And Orban has done that to a great extent. He also started a youth party. As he got older, the party got older, Fidesz. But I do think that he has kind of taken ethnic purity of the Hungarian people and is blaming Soros. And he's made very clear that because he's a Jew. But it's also true about Muslims. And so I do think there's this identification of the other that is not part of the ethnic pure nationalism that has arisen, and primarily in Central Europe. What I think is interesting, it's the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, and the countries of Central and Eastern Europe really were born at that period, and they were born on the basis of national identity, because they had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and people felt they needed their own country. Just not so parenthetically, I want to say Czechoslovakia, the first president of Czechoslovakia was a man called Thomas Masaryk, who married an American, Charlotte Gehrig, and he took her maiden name as his middle name. If you can imagine, they were married in the last quarter of the 19th century. That was really something. And then the Czechoslovak constitution was based on the American constitution with one significant addition. It had equal rights language in it in 1918. But the countries were founded on national identity. And so as the European experiment of the European Union all of a sudden seemed faceless, and there were a bunch of bureaucrats in Brussels making rules, all of a sudden this national identity fervor erupted. And it's fine to have a national identity. We all want to know who we are, and either linguistic, ethnic, or religious. But when my identity hates your identity, that is where the problem comes. Patriotism is great. Hyper-nationalism is very dangerous. And so we're seeing that part also, which scares me about the things that are going on in Europe and in other places of blaming the other.
So you also cite the history of Masaryk and his final demise is very tragic, and the role that your father was playing at the time as a sort of warning sign of what can happen when good people aren't really sort of supported and built up. And can you talk a little bit about that example?
It's interesting. Yeah. That Masaryk was the son of the first president, and he had actually been in England with the government in exile, and I knew him when I was a little girl. And then when I told you my father was ambassador to Yugoslavia, the little girl in the national costume that gave flowers at the airport, that's what I did for a living. And what was interesting, this Jan Masaryk became the foreign minister. And when he came to Yugoslavia, he always had his right arm in a sling. And I remember asking my father, you know, was his arm broken? He said, no, he just wouldn't shake hands with communists. But what was interesting, and I don't want to get overly complicated here, but what happened was the government in Czechoslovakia after World War II was a coalition government. And there had been a sense, having told you about Munich, that the Czechoslovaks felt let down by the West. And the Soviet Union pretended, actually, that they might have defended Czechoslovakia if the French had kept their word. And so there was this kind of feeling about, well, maybe the Russians weren't so bad. And Czechoslovakia, during the interwar period, had both a legal communist party and a legal socialist party. So all of a sudden, there was this coalition government. And Jan Masaryk was a Democrat that had a communist as his deputy. And it was a very complicated time. And what happened was that Czechoslovakia wanted to accept the Marshall Plan, and they were forbidden from doing that by the Soviet Union. And all of a sudden, it was clear that the Soviets were going to, and communism was going to win. And yet, and this is one of the lessons out of this, is that democracy in Czechoslovakia was undermined by the communists who used democratic means to push the Democrats out and used elections and coalition governments, and people were not vigilant enough. And when we came to the United States, my father said that he was afraid that Americans took their democracy too much for granted, that there was kind of a sense not a little bit too complacent, because he had seen democracy undermined twice, actually.
So broadening out, and again, I promise I will be coming back to the United States, but you mentioned the Soviet Union there, and you write a fair bit about the current president, President Putin. I think you call him a very successful product of a Soviet patriotic education or some framing like that.
Yeah. That's when I'm polite.
When you're not polite, what do you say, and what do you take of Russia's current actions globally in places like Syria and elsewhere, and also in the social media in the United States?
Well, let me just say that I used to be a Soviet expert, and when I look at my library, I kind of think, is it archaeology? And actually not. It's quite relevant to some of the things that have been going on. And in 91, after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, I was a professor and I was running a think tank, and I was asked to do a whole survey of all of Europe in terms of how people felt after the end of the Cold War. And we had a lot of great questionnaires, and we had focus groups. And I will never forget a focus group outside of Moscow where this man stands up and says, I'm so embarrassed. We used to be a superpower, and now we're Bangladesh with missiles. And we had been asked to do something at the end of the Cold War that had never been done before, which was how to devolve the power of your major adversary without a war. And so it was a very complicated time, and I think the Russians really did feel disrespected, even though we tried very hard to respect them. And what happened is that Putin has identified himself with the loss of grandeur that Russia and the Soviet Union had had. And I think that he's done that very successfully. He has played a weak hand very well. And he has, certainly in terms of acting illegally as far as Ukraine is concerned, and pushing them because they were looking more towards the West. The Russians have had an interest in having an influential role in the Middle East for a long time. They are now doing that so that there are agreements where the Russians and the Turks and the Iranians actually are talking to each other, and the United States is not there. And so Putin keeps really pushing. He has managed to weaponize information by the kind of work that he's done by using the media and putting false information into it and undermining the democratic system in Central and Eastern Europe during the elections, Brexit. And also, I believe that he played a very large role in what was happening in the United States. So what do I call him? He's a KGB officer, and he knows how to do it. He is a product of KGB education, and there's nobody that does propaganda better than the KGB, and that's what he's doing. And he is, I think, in many ways, as I said, identifying with this loss of grandeur. And the Russians, even though their economy is not doing well, is willing to put up with all that because he has returned, in so many ways, Russia. The new defense strategy that the Trump administration put out are saying that our biggest problem is competition from Russia and China. So all of a sudden, to have put Russia on the same level as China, it's a gift to Putin.
So switching across another ocean there, you talked about the Russian, you talked about wondering that they were Bangladesh with missiles. So North Korea, you could argue, wishes it was as developed as Bangladesh, but they do have missiles.
Right.
And that is giving them a frightening degree of relevance in today's geopolitics. And yet you also say in the book, one of the, I'm not sure I call it complimentary, but potentially complimentary things about President Trump is that you wouldn't rule out the fact that his complete lack of respect for diplomatic convention could produce some unconventional results. And it seems from his quotes, including even from today at his press conference, that he is looking at North Korea as a place where his unconventional style might get results. Okay. What's your read?
Well, first of all, let me say, I first came to Seattle in 1950 with my father, who was teaching in the summer at the University of Washington. And the reason I say that, in June 25th, 1950, was when the Korean War began. And everything goes back to the Korean War. And the fact that we don't have a peace treaty with North Korea, just have an armistice, and the Korean Peninsula has been divided ever since. And it has been unbelievably complicated. During the Clinton administration, we spent a lot of time on Korea, and I won't go through the whole history, but I am still the highest level sitting official to have met with the North Korean leader. I went there in the summer of 2000, and we were trying to sort out what they were doing in terms of their missiles and their nuclear capabilities. Even as I discussed which countries I see with fascist tendencies, the only country that I think is truly fascist is North Korea, because it's complete control over everything and a poor population and various aspects of things. We know very little about North Korea. And even when I went, I knew very little about Kim Jong-il, the father of this guy. The only thing I really did know was that and I take full responsibility for Dennis Rodman, because what happened, we knew that Kim Jong-il loved basketball, so I took over a basketball autographed by Michael Jordan, and it's in their Holy of Holies. One of the things, we had been told by our intelligence that the father was crazy and a pervert. I found out he wasn't crazy. I won't go through the whole story, but the bottom line is that I do think that what I find interesting is that Kim Jong-un has managed to get us engaged in a way that could be very good for him and good for us, frankly. The issue in terms of, there is a whole theory in foreign policy, which is the crazy man theory, that if you keep the other country off balance, Nixon did this in terms of the way he was dealing with China for a while and just generally, but the idea and unpredictability, but you can't be unpredictable all the time. That is very dangerous, or crazy all the time. And so the question is whether, given the kinds of threats that Trump was making against North Korea and calling him Rocket Man and all kinds of things, it's conceivable that through the pressure, he has managed to get him to the table. The question is, what now? And whether they are at all prepared for what are going to be very complicated talks. I happen to believe it's important to have talks. Diplomacy is not a gift. Diplomacy is the language that you use primarily to talk to people that you can't agree with in order to try to figure out some solutions. By the way, President Macron is in, the President of France is in the U.S. now, and I raise this because I have a lot of, one of my friends is a former French foreign minister, and they're wonderfully cynical. And so I was asking for what is the definition of diplomacy, and the answer was it allows you to talk to monsters. So I do think it has to be seen as a way, as just a tool to talk to other countries. But you have to be prepared. And before I went to North Korea, we had spent an incredible amount of time. President Clinton had asked for a total review of our Korean policy from former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry. There were a lot of preparations. We all worked very hard. And I think it's unclear as to how much preparation has been done. And then the other part, let's presume that everything goes well. There will be an incredible amount of work afterwards in terms of diplomacy. And the State Department has been gutted. The main guy that was in charge of North Korea policy left. And presumably we're going to have a new Secretary of State who has just been to North Korea, which I think is positive. But there is going to be an awful lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of discipline. And you can't have the kind of thing, all of a sudden President Trump is saying that he thinks that Kim Jong-un is an honorable man, which is not what he said 3 weeks ago. So I think the unpredictability of the unpredictability is something that we have to be very watchful about.
So you just brought up there the State Department losing its position, and you talked about being gutted as the department that you were the former custodian of. How concerned are you about what's happened in the State Department over the last year and a half in terms of and its ability to help the United States do the job of diplomacy, as you described?
I'm very concerned, and concerned for a number of reasons. I was in a session with some Republicans just as the new administration was coming in, and I was talking to them about, you know, who was going to be in the government, and they said, well, we can't have these people that worked for the Democratic administration because they're not loyal Americans. And I just kind of, you know, what? The Foreign Service officers and the civil servants that have worked throughout the government, especially in the State Department, the Foreign Service officers, these are people that have worked for many administrations and are public servants that are loyal Americans. So there was this kind of distrust of the State Department in the first place. Then the issue was the budget. And I think one of the issues there is, I think people are not familiar enough with the numbers. I am very supportive of our military. I think it's one of the aspects that I learned when I was in office. Well, first of all, I fell in love with Americans in uniform during World War II when they came and liberated. So, but I do think in terms of the partnership of force and diplomacy, I'm going to do a call out now because General Shali Kashvili's widow is here with us. And what happened was he and I worked together very carefully in terms of force and diplomacy. And there was one time that he and I were standing in front of the Situation Room at the White House, and Secretary Rubin, Secretary of Treasury, came by, and he looked at us and he said, force and diplomacy. And Charlie said, and which is which? Because really you do need those two things together. And so I think that, so the budget for the military at the moment, it was just voted, was that the budget for the Pentagon is around $700 billion. The budget for the State Department is kind of like $39 billion. And I think that contrast is so stunning because you do need the two together. So people left, people are not, and the budget for the State Department has to go for the programs that are out there, for the to pay the diplomats, to have secure buildings, and in fact to then pay our dues to international organizations. And it's really not a lot of money. And when the Congress wanted to give Secretary Tillerson more money, he didn't want it. And plus, he was reorganizing the State Department in some way that didn't make much sense. And so you could now say low morale at the State Department is a hyphenated word, because people don't know what they're supposed to be doing. I do think that I was encouraged by the, I don't agree with a lot of the things that Secretary-designate Pompeo's been talking about, but he did talk about needing to rehabilitate the State Department and a belief in democracy programs, and so I hope that he follows through on that.
I wouldn't be doing my job for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation if I didn't touch on one aspect of that, which is about the foreign aid budget. And in your book, one of the bits of good news you do cite at the end is how in some of these global trends that we have been seeing progress against extreme poverty, against disease, against some other areas, and the United States plays a critical role there. Again, that's a tool that hasn't been being used as much by this administration, and the proposed cuts to foreign aid were even steeper than the proposed cuts to the overall State Department. But just wondering how you see that rolling out and how critical you see that as a dimension of U.S. foreign policy.
Well, I think it's absolutely essential. I teach a course, by the way. I say foreign policy is trying to get some country to do what you want. That's all it is. So what are the tools? And there are not a lot of tools in the national security toolbox. There is diplomacy, bilateral and multilateral. And then the economic tools, the carrots, which are aid and trade, and the sticks, which are sanctions, then the threat of the use of force, intelligence and law enforcement, that's it. And aid has been, I think, a remarkably important tool because it does obviously assist countries and works on their economic and their health issues in a number of different ways. It is not easy to get, by the way, basically when you try to get people to vote, kind of putting foreign and assistance together is not a good combination of words. And so I think it's important to kind of see it as development assistance, but also national security support. But I think that it's very needed in what happens, and it's not a lot of money, frankly, and I think it is very important. But what has happened now, there is this whole attitude that those foreigners are taking advantage of us, that the United States is a victim. I find it stunning to think that we are a victim. And then, in fact, also kind of a sense that people are punished by saying, I'm going to cut all your foreign assistance, even if it's not a lot. And basically, we are undercutting the life and the health of people in other countries who are very important to us in so many ways. So I do see it as a very important tool. There's a very interesting op-ed today in the New York Times, which is there's always this question, what comes first, political development or economic development? You argue that in graduate school a lot. And the bottom line is they have to go together because democracy has to deliver and people want to vote and eat. And so this professor at Yale was writing about the fact that people that are interested in human rights, which I think many of us are, certainly you are and Bill Gates is and the organization, is that it also has to be not only about whether people can live freely, but whether they can exist economically. And that economic development and inequality that's created is also essential. And I thought it actually was a perfect op-ed to go with my book because I think that if there is economic inequality, it does create that division in groups, which is then exacerbated by some demagogic leader. So I do think we have to look at assistance as both economically and in terms of the human rights aspect of them.
Okay. So at this stage, I'm going to ask, most of you will have piece of paper that were on your chairs, I think. So we are going to try and collect some questions from the audience, and there'll be people coming by the aisle. So if you want to start writing down, or if you haven't, write those questions and then collect them, and then we'll be able to touch on a few of them before we finish up. But anytime, just Virginia, you talk a little bit in the book about the history of the America First slogan and its background and how it's been resonating in the current context and its historical context. And that also, the historical context was a lot around not engaging in multilateral machinery. It was the spirit that around the time of the founding of the UN and going into World War II and out of it. Just both, how do you see the risks of that playing within the domestic political discourse, and how do you see that linked to American support for multilateral institutions, particularly the United Nations?
Well, I do think that America is an exceptional country, but partially geographically also, a continent nation that was protected by two oceans and had friendly neighbors on both sides. And there is kind of a sense that we can exist by ourselves. George Washington and his farewell speech and no entangling alliances, and why should we worry about all that? So there is this kind of tradition of Americans staying apart, but it became very clear, and as I talked before about World War I, we ultimately did get involved in that. Then there was a period, and it was this interwar period, where Americans, and this is where America First came from, which is in the 30s, kind of why should we be involved with a bunch of people someplace, and what earthly reason would we care about that? The bottom line is that it is the duty of every president to protect our people, our territory, and our way of life. More and more, it was evident that all three of those things depended on what was going on in other countries. And so we go then into World War II saved a lot of people's lives. But nevertheless, there's kind of this lingering aspect of why do we need to be involved with others? U.S., even though Woodrow Wilson was really one of the creators of the whole concept of the League of Nations, it was voted against by Congress. And it's the U.S. that basically started the United Nations, FDR and then Harry Truman specifically. But Americans don't like the word multilateralism. It has too many syllables and it ends in an ism. But all it means is partnership. And I think that the world is complicated enough that there need to be kind of, I don't believe in world government, and the UN is not world government, it is a composition of nation states. And I think that there are levels of cooperation that can come out of international organizations. And there are certain issues out there that no matter how powerful the United States is, cannot be dealt with alone. One of them is nuclear proliferation. The other is climate change. By the way, the Earth is not flat. I think we all can understand there is climate change. And I do think that there are cooperative methods that are needed that can come from the United Nations and a variety of other organizations. And I have said that organizations and people at age 70 need a little refurbishing. And so that is what's happening now. I think that the UN does need some reform. But one of the things, by the way, the US thought the UN needed some reform for quite a long time. It's a very big bureaucracy. And then at the end of the Cold War, we wanted that bureaucracy to do gymnastics. And so when I went up there, one of my assignments was to work for UN reform. The only problem was that the previous administration, under President Bush, had done a lot of activities with the UN, but had not paid our peacekeeping bills. And then Congress had decided unilaterally not to pay what we were assessed. So there I was trying to get reform while we were helping to create an artificial financial crisis. So our best friends, the British, spoke at the General Assembly, delivering a line they had waited more than 200 years to say, which was representation without taxation. Hard to push for reform if you're not paying your bills, which is exactly what's happening now. Again, Congress has unilaterally said that we will only pay a certain 25%, or when we're supposed to pay more. And so I do think it needs help. The other part that I have been very interested in for a long time, the United Nations is based on the nation state. But the truth is that there are other non-state actors that play a very important role in all of this, which are corporations and non-governmental organizations, and Bill Gates, I mean, is a non-state actor who has done an incredible amount in terms of assistance in a variety of places. So I have been arguing for some time that non-state actors need to be part of the system much earlier, to be there at the table when decisions are being made about how to handle a crisis somewhere, so that it isn't just kind of come in and deal with what's already been decided. But there definitely need to be some changes. There need to be a way that regional organizations fit in. But the world today cannot exist on the basis of not having some organization that can blend our interests rather than just the nation states, and especially as hypernationalism is taking hold in a variety of places. So I think we're in a very, very complicated world at the moment, and there are those that are taking advantage of it in terms of pushing the kinds of things I'm talking about in my book, and those that are trying to normalize things and say, yeah, this is like this and then we'll get over it. We can't normalize what's going on. We have to recognize, and that's why my book is a warning, because we have to make sure that we get out of this era with some kind of a better organizational system and not depend on demagogic leaders taking advantage of the divisions that are in societies at the moment.
So you talked there importantly about international institutions. How worried are you about our domestic institutions?
Well, I am worried. By the way, there's a, you know, that saying we all know, see something, say something. I have added to it, do something. So I've written my book, and I have my to-do list about what people need to do. First of all, we cannot let our press be demonized by calling it the enemy of the people. We cannot allow our judicial branch to be denigrated by having a president who doesn't seem to regard it highly and thinks he's above the law. I think what we need to do is really get very active in terms of, I hope a lot of people run for office. I hope the people that aren't running for office will support the people that they want to see in office and understand the responsibilities of citizenship and that we have to, every vote counts. And so we have to register people to vote and we have to be supportive of active involvement in our democratic institutions. I have kind of a paradoxical statement in my book, which is, I believe in the resiliency of democracy, but I'm also concerned about the fragility of democracy. And it really requires people to act and be involved and take an interest in things. And then I think that we need to have civil discussions and not decide that just because we disagree with somebody that they're stupid. And we have to listen to other than things that we just cannot be in our echo chamber. You should all be glad that I live in the other Washington because I drive and I listen to right-wing radio and it makes me very mad and I'm, you know, yell a lot and someday I'll be arrested. But I do think that one has to listen. And then I have to say, I'm sure
you
there
can
are
always
many
seek asylum in Bosnia. That
I think that I'm sure that many people in the audience feel this way. I was so moved by the children that were marching, I know practically every speaker in every book quotes Robert Frost, so I will do that. Robert Frost said, as he got older, the teachers got younger. And I do think that those kids were really teaching us something that they want gun sanity so they don't have to go to school in flak jackets. And I think we need to listen to what they're saying and have them be active with us. And by the way, I would like to congratulate the young woman in her poem, because I think that is also part of it.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Madeleine Albright was the first woman to serve as U.S. Secretary of State. Seattle Arts and Lectures presented her conversation with Mark Sussman of the Gates Foundation on Tuesday, April 24th at the Paramount Theater. KUOW's Jenny Cecil Moore recorded the conversation. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Catch up with other great Seattle area talks by subscribing to our podcast. We appreciate your likes and comments. Tune in again soon.